posed a real threat to the established order. Just before the insurgents cut the telephone lines, an employee of the bin Laden organization, which was still renovating the Grand Mosque, called the company headquarters and reported what had happened. Then a representative of the company notified King Khalid. Turkey returned from Tunis to Jeddah at 9 o'clock that night and drove his own car to Mecca. The entire city had been evacuated and the streets were spookily vacant. The giant stadium lights that usually illuminated the immense mosque were cut off, along with all power, so the building loomed mountainously in shadow. Turkey went to a hotel where his uncle, Prince Sultan, who was the Minister of Defense, was waiting for him. As Turkey entered the hotel, a shot rang out from one of the rebel snipers in the minarets, shattering the glass door in his hands. Later that evening, Turkey moved to the command post 100 meters from the mosque, where he would remain for the next 2 weeks. Most of the hostages had been let go, but an undetermined number of them were still locked in the sanctuary. No one knew how many insurgents there were, how many weapons they had, what kinds of preparations had been made. About 100 security officers from the Interior Ministry had made an initial attempt to regain the mosque. They were immediately gunned down. Forces from the Saudi Army and the National Guard soon joined the surviving security officers. Before the princes on the scene could order a military assault on the mosque, however, they first had to gain permission from the Saudi clerical establishment, and there was no certainty that they would receive that blessing. The Quran forbids violence of any kind within the Grand Mosque. Not even a plant can be uprooted. So the prospect of a gun battle within the holy confines posed a dilemma for both the government and the ulama. The king would face revolt from his own men if he ordered them to open fire within the sanctuary. On the other hand, if the ulama refused to issue a fatwa endorsing the government's right to reclaim the mosque, they could be seen as siding with the rebels. The historic compact between the royal family and the clergy would be broken. And who could guess the outcome? The leader of the ulama was Abdulaziz bin Baz, blind, 70 years old, an eminent religious scholar, but a man who was suspicious of science and hostile to modernity. He claimed that the sun rotated around the earth and that the man landing on the moon had never occurred. Now bin Baz found himself in an awkward and compromised position. Otaibi had been his student in Medina. Whatever bargain was struck during the meeting between the ulama and King Khalid, the government emerged with a fatwa authorizing the use of lethal force. With this decree, Prince Sultan ordered an artillery barrage, followed by frontal assaults on 3 of the main gates. They never got close to breaching the rebel defenses. Inside the mosque were 400 or 500 insurgents, including some women and children. They included not only Saudis, but also Yemenis, Kuwaitis, Egyptians, and even some American black Muslims. In the weeks leading up to the Hajj, they had stolen automatic weapons from the armory of the National Guard and smuggled them into the compound on biers on which the dead were commonly brought for ritual washing. The rebels had hidden their arms and supplies within the hundreds of tiny underground chambers beneath the courtyard that were used as hermitages for pilgrims on retreat. Now they were well fortified, and they had taken up commanding positions in the upper stories of the mosque. Snipers were picking off Saudi forces whenever they showed themselves. In the field headquarters outside the mosque, a number of senior princes and the generals of rival services congregated, and their reckless orders, compounded by abundant contradictory advice from the military attachés from the United States and Pakistan, were causing confusion and needless fatalities. In the middle of the day, Sultan directed a suicidal helicopter assault in which troops were lowered on ropes into the vast courtyard in the center of the mosque. They were slaughtered. At that point, the king turned to the young Prince Turkey, putting him in charge. Turkey worked out a strategy that would minimize casualties and damage to the holy shrine. The first priority was intelligence, and for that he called on the bin Ladens. The brothers had maps and electrical layouts and all the technical information about the mosque that would be critical for the assault that Turkey was contemplating. Salim bin Laden, the oldest of the brothers and the head of the clan, arrived on the hood of a car, brandishing a machine gun. Salim was a wonderful character, so much the opposite of his pious, remote, and taciturn father. He was known throughout the kingdom for his bravado and his nutty humor, traits that endeared him to the king, who loved him despite the practical jokes that Salim sometimes played on him. A daredevil pilot, Salim would buzz the ruler's desert camp and carry on such antics in the sky that the king eventually banned him from flying. Once, according to family legend, Salim had a hemorrhoid operation, and he had a videotape of the procedure sent to the king. In this stoic culture, few people, perhaps no one else, exercised such rough liberties. Otebi and his followers had control of the mosque's public address system, and they were using this opportunity to broadcast their message to the world. Despite the government's efforts to marginalize the insurgents as religious fanatics upset by the spread of video games and football, Otebi's brazen demands echoed through the streets of Mecca, electrifying the coffee houses and shisha bars of the kingdom. Otebi insisted on the adoption of Islamic non-Western values and the rupture of diplomatic relations with Western countries, thus rolling back the changes that had opened the society to modernity. The Saudi Arabia these men wanted to create would be radically isolated. The royal family would be thrown out of power, and there would be a full accounting of the money that they had taken from the Saudi people. Not only the king, but also the ulama who countenanced his rule would be denounced as sinful and unjust. Oil exports to the United States would be cut off, and all foreign civilian and military experts would be expelled from the Arabian Peninsula. These demands foreshadowed those that Osama bin Laden would make 15 years later. By Friday, the fourth day of the siege, Saudi forces had regained the upper stories of the Grand Mosque and two of the minarets. Battles flared in the covered corridors surrounding the Kaaba, and the stench of death clouded the air. The bodies of dead rebels had been mutilated, their faces shot off by female insurgents to keep them from being identified. One of the bodies government troops recovered more or less intact was that of Muhammad Abdullah al-Qahtani, the purported Mahdi, whose jaw was blown away. But even the death of the Mahdi did not put an end to the rebellion. Using maps of the compound provided by Salim, Turkey oversaw a series of reconnaissance probes by special security forces, who slipped in and out among the 100 doors, retrieving bodies of fallen soldiers. But Turkey wanted to see for himself. He exchanged his ministerial robes for the khaki uniform of an ordinary soldier. Then he and a handful of men, including his brother Prince Saud and Salim bin Laden, entered the Holy Mosque. The mosque's lengthy arcades and grand plaza were eerily vacant. Turkey and his companions discovered that the main body of rebels had taken refuge in the warren of underground prayer rooms, carved into the lava that underlay the great courtyard. The subterranean hive that the rebels now occupied was easily defended. The government had no idea how long the insurgents could hold out on the dates and water they had cached in the storerooms. Nor was there any possibility of an assault upon this labyrinth, which offered infinite opportunities for ambush. Thousands of soldiers and an unknown number of hostages would die. For half an hour, the two sons of Faisal and the eldest son of Mohammed bin Laden crept about, sketching the sight lines of the rebels' positions and their probable lines of defense. The kingdom itself weighed in the balance of their actions, for if they failed to secure the holy ground, they would lose the trust of the Saudi people. Nothing in the world was more sacred to them and to Muslims everywhere than this mosque. Now it was a surreal battlefield. The early bombardment had done appalling damage. Turkey noticed that even the pigeons had fled. From the earliest accounts by pilgrims, pigeons were constantly circumnavigating the Holy Mosque in the same counterclockwise manner. It seemed to him that the devotion of nature had been interrupted by this bloody human quarrel. One of the ideas the government entertained was to flood the underground chambers, then electrocute everyone inside with high-voltage cables. Such a plan, however, did not distinguish the hostages from their captors. And besides, Turkey realized, you would need the entire Red Sea to fill it. Another notion was to put explosive-laden saddles on dogs and detonate them by remote control. With such hopeless alternatives in front of him, Turkey could have called upon the American Central Intelligence Agency, which was training Saudi Army Special Forces in the nearby city of Taif. But he had found that when immediate action was needed, the French were less complicated than the Americans. He consulted the legendary spy Count Claude Alexandre de Moranche, who was then head of the French Secret Service. A huge commanding presence, de Moranche recommended gas. Turkey agreed, but insisted that it be non-lethal. The idea was to render the insurgents unconscious. A team of three French commandos, from the Groupe d'Intervention de la Gendarmerie Nationale, GIGN, arrived in Mecca. Because of the prohibition against non-Muslims entering the holy city, they converted to Islam in a brief formal ceremony. The commandos pumped gas into the underground chambers, but perhaps because the rooms were so bafflingly interconnected, the gas failed and the resistance continued. With casualties climbing, Saudi forces drilled holes into the courtyard and dropped grenades into the rooms below, indiscriminately killing many hostages but driving the remaining rebels into more open areas where they could be picked off by sharpshooters. More than 2 weeks after the assault began, the surviving rebels finally surrendered. Otaibi was among them, looking like a wild man with his matted hair and beard, which jutted defiantly toward the television cameras that recorded the emergence of the rebels stumbling out of the underground chambers. His defiance had faded once the tragedy concluded. Turkey went to see him in the hospital where his wounds were being attended. Otaibi jumped off the bed, grabbed the prince's hand, and kissed it. "Please ask King Khalid to forgive me," he cried. "I promise not to do it again." Turkey was too startled to answer at first. "Forgiveness?" he finally said. "Ask forgiveness of God." The government divided Otaibi and 62 of his disciples among 8 different cities where, on January 9, 1980, they were beheaded. It was the largest execution in Saudi Arabian history. The Saudi government admitted that 127 of its men had been killed in the uprising and 461 injured. About a dozen worshippers were killed, along with 117 rebels. Unofficial accounts, however, put the number of dead at more than 4,000. In any case, the kingdom was traumatized. The holiest place in the world had been defiled by Muslims. The authority of the royal family had been openly challenged. After this, nothing could remain the same. Saudi Arabia had come to a place where it would have to change. But in which direction? Toward openness, liberality, tolerance, modernity, and Western ideas of democratic progress? Or toward greater authoritarianism and religious repression? In the early days of the siege, Osama bin Laden and his brother Mahrouz were arrested. They were driving home from Al Barud, the family farm off the road from Jeddah to Mecca. Authorities spotted the dust trail of their car coming out of the desert and thought they were fleeing rebels. At the time of their arrest, the brothers professed to be unaware that the siege had taken place. They stayed in custody for a day or two, but their social prominence protected them. Osama remained secluded in his house for a week. He had been opposed to Otaibi and the extreme Salafists who surrounded him. 5 years later, however, he would tell a fellow Mujahideen in Peshawar that Otaibi and his followers were true Muslims who were innocent of any crime. In the month between the surrender of the rebels and their mass execution, there was a new shock to the Islamic world. On Christmas Eve, 1979, Soviet troops entered Afghanistan. "I was enraged and went there at once," bin Laden later claimed. "I arrived within days before the end of 1979. According to Jamal Khalifa, bin Laden had never even heard of the country of Afghanistan until that point, and did not actually go there until 1984, which is when he first became noticed in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Bin Laden explained that the trips he made before then were a big secret so that my family wouldn't find out. He became a courier, he said, delivering charitable donations from wealthy Saudis. I used to hand over the money and head straight back, so I wasn't really familiar with what was going on. The most influential figure in bin Laden's involvement with the Afghan cause was a charismatic Palestinian scholar and mystic named Abdullah Azzam. Born in Jenin in 1941, Azzam fled to Jordan after Israel captured the West Bank in 1967. He went to Al-Azhar University in Cairo, where he gained a doctorate in Islamic jurisprudence in 1973, 2 years behind his friend Omar Abdul Rahman, the blind sheikh. He then joined the faculty of the University of Jordan, but his Palestinian activism got him dismissed in 1980. Soon he found a job leading prayers in the school mosque at King Abdulaziz University in Jeddah. For a roused young Muslim such as Osama bin Laden, Sheikh Abdullah Azzam embodied in a modern fashion the warrior priest, a figure that was as well established in Islamic tradition as the samurai in Japan. Azzam combined piety and learning with a serene and bloody intransigence. His slogan was Jihad and the rifle alone, no negotiations, no conferences, no dialogues. Around his neck he wore the black and white Palestinian kifaya or scarf, a reminder of his reputation as a freedom fighter. By the time he arrived in Jeddah, he was already well known for his courage and oratory. Tall and sturdy, with an impressive black beard distinctively forked by two bright streaks of white and dark eyes that radiated conviction, he mesmerized audiences with his vision of an Islam that would dominate the world through the force of arms. Despite his growing body of followers, Azzam was restless in Jeddah and eager to participate in the nascent Afghan resistance. Jihad for him was like water for a fish, his wife, Umm Muhammad, said. He soon found a position for teaching the Quran and Arabic language at the International Islamic University in Islamabad, Pakistan, and moved there as soon as he could in November 1981. Soon he was spending each weekend in Peshawar, which had become the headquarters of the Afghan resistance against the Soviet occupation. He visited the refugee camps and saw appalling suffering. He met with the leaders of the Mujahideen, the Holy Warriors, who made Peshawar their base. "I reached Afghanistan and I could not believe my eyes," Azzam would later recall in his countless videos and speeches around the world. "I felt as if I had been reborn." In his renderings, the war was primeval, metaphysical, fought in a landscape of miracles. The Afghans, in his tableau, represented humanity in a pristine state, a righteous, pious, pre-industrial people, struggling against the brutal, soulless, mechanized force of modernity. In this war, the believers were aided by the invisible hands of angels. Azzam spoke of Russian helicopters being snared by ropes, and he claimed that flocks of birds functioned as an early warning radar system by taking wing when Soviet jets were still over the horizon. Repeatedly in his stories, Mujahideen discover bullet holes in their clothes when they themselves are not injured, and the bodies of those who are martyred do not putrefy, but remain pure and sweet-smelling. The struggle of Islam, as Qutb had framed it, and as Azzam deeply believed, was against Jahiliya, the world of unbelief that had existed before Islam, which was still corrupting and undermining the faithful with the lures of materialism, secularism, and sexual equality. Here, in this primitive land, so stunted by poverty and illiteracy and patriarchal tribal codes, the heroic and seemingly doomed Afghan jihad against the Soviet colossus had the elements of an epical moment in history. In the skillful hands of Sheikh Abdullah Azzam, the legend of the Afghan holy warriors would be packaged and sold all over the world. Azzam returned to Jeddah frequently, staying in bin Laden's guest flat on his trips to the kingdom. He held recruiting sessions in bin Laden's apartment, where he magnetized young Saudis with his portraits of the suffering of the refugees and the courage of the Afghan Mujahideen. "You have to do this," he told them. "It is your duty. You have to leave everything and go." Bin Laden revered Azzam, who provided a model for the man he would become. For his part, Azzam was enchanted by his well-connected young host with his monastic habits. "He lives in his house the life of the poor," Azzam marveled. "I never did see a single table or chair. Any Jordanian or Egyptian laborer's house was better than the house of Osama. At the same time, if you asked him for ₹1 million for the Mujahideen, he would write you out a check on the spot." Still, Azzam was a little discomforted when, in the sweltering Saudi heat, bin Laden left the air conditioner off. "If you have it, why don't you use it?" he asked petulantly. Bin Laden reluctantly accommodated his guest's request. Soon, Jeddah became a transit station for young men who were answering Sheikh Abdullah's call to join the caravan of the Afghan Jihad. Paid agents rounded up prospects, pocketing half of the money, typically several $100s, that the recruits received when they signed up. Young Muslim pilgrims were particular targets. To get them to the front, agents promised them jobs with aid organizations that never materialized. Fugitives from Algeria and Egypt slipped into the country and were provided with false papers by Saudi intelligence. The Saudi Bin Laden Group, which maintained an office in Cairo for hiring skilled laborers to work on the two holy mosques, became known as a pipeline for radicals who wanted to fight in Afghanistan. It is probable that Zawahiri connected to the Egyptians coming through Jeddah, and that would have brought him into bin Laden's realm. Bin Laden opened a halfway house for the recruits and even put them up in his own apartment. In the summers, he ran special military camps for high school and college students. Despite his youth, he rapidly emerged as a talented fundraiser. Wealthy individuals, including members of the royal family, eagerly contributed. The Saudi government encouraged these efforts by offering steep discounts on the national airline for flights to Pakistan, the dropping-off point for jihad. Crown Prince Abdullah personally donated dozens of trucks for the cause. It was a thrilling national effort, although it established charitable habits and associations that would later become ruinous. The people who rallied to the Afghan jihad felt that Islam itself was threatened by the advance of communism. Afghanistan meant little to most of them, but the faith of the Afghan people meant a great deal. They were drawing a line against the retreat of their religion, which was God's last word and the only hope of human salvation. Jamal Khalifa was completely persuaded by Azzam's arguments. Later, he spoke to his friend Osama and declared that he had decided to go to Afghanistan. As a sign of his approval, bin Laden proposed that Jamal marry his favorite sister, Sheikha. She was divorced and several years older than Osama, who was taking care of her and her three children. Because Jamal wasn't allowed to see her at first, his friend extravagantly praised her pleasant nature, her humor, and her piety. "What are you talking about?" Khalifa said. "Suppose I go to die." But he agreed to meet her as soon as it could be properly arranged. When he did, he decided that Sheikha was the best I ever met in my whole life. He put off the marriage for a year, however, in case he was martyred in Afghanistan. Bin Laden also wanted to go openly to Afghanistan, but he could not get permission from the authorities. "The Saudi government asked me officially not to enter Afghanistan due to how close my family is to the Saudi leadership," bin Laden later said. "They ordered me to stay in Peshawar because if the Russians arrested me, that would be proof of our support against the Soviet Union. I didn't obey their order. They thought my entry into Afghanistan was damning to them. I didn't listen." He would have to defy another authority as well, which was even more difficult for him. His mother forbade him to go. He begged for her permission, saying that he would be going there only to take care of the families of the Mujahideen. He said he would call every day. Finally, he promised, "I won't even get near Afghanistan." Chapter 5. The Miracles. 1 month after the Soviet invasion, Prince Turki Al-Faisal paid a visit to Pakistan. he was shaken by the Soviet takeover of Afghanistan, which he saw as the first step in a march toward the warm waters of the Persian Gulf. Pakistan would be next. He believed the Soviet Union's ultimate target was to control the Strait of Hormuz at the base of the Gulf, where Oman reaches toward Iran like a fishhook for an open mouth. From there, the Soviets could control the supply route for the supertankers that ferried the petroleum from Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Kuwait, and Iran. Whoever commanded the strait had a knife at the throat of the world's oil supply. Turkey's colleagues in the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI, briefed him on the Afghan resistance, then took him to the refugee camps outside Peshawar. Turkey was appalled by the scale of the suffering. He went back to the kingdom vowing to dedicate more money to the Mujahideen, although he believed that these ragged soldiers could never defeat the Red Army. Afghanistan was gone, he decided. He only hoped to delay the inevitable Soviet invasion of Pakistan. Similar thinking was going on in Washington, especially by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the U.S. National Security Advisor for the Carter administration. Brzezinski, however, saw the invasion as an opportunity. He wrote to Carter immediately saying, "Now we can give the USSR its own Vietnam War." Looking for an ally in this endeavor, the Americans naturally turned to the Saudis, that is, to Turkey, the American-educated prince who held the Afghan account. Turkey became the key man in the covert alliance of the United States and the Saudis to funnel money and arms to the resistance through the Pakistani ISI. It was vital to keep this program secret in order to prevent the Soviets from having the excuse they sought to invade Pakistan. Until the end of the war, the Saudis would match the Americans dollar for dollar, starting with only $75,000 but growing into billions. The immediate problem Turkey faced was that the Mujahideen were little more than disorganized mobs. There were about 170 armed Afghan militias in the mid-1980s. In order to manage this chaos, the ISI anointed 6 major emigre parties as the designated recipients for aid. Afghan refugees, who numbered 3.27 million by 1988, had to sign up with one of the 6 official parties to qualify for food and supplies. The 2 largest of these, headed by Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Burhanuddin Rabbani, each had 800,000 people in Peshawar under their authority. Turkey forcibly created a 7th official party that would better represent Saudi interests. Ittihad-e-Islami, Islamic Union, was privately funded through bin Laden and others and headed by Abdul Rusal Sayyaf, an imposing and dashing Afghan warlord, 6 feet 3 inches tall, who draped himself in colorful blankets. Sayyaf spoke excellent classical Arabic from his years studying at Al-Azhar University in Cairo. His devout Wahhabi beliefs were out of step with the Sufi traditions that predominated in Afghanistan before the war, but they were very much attuned to the interests of the Saudi Arabian government and its religious establishment. These 7 Mujahideen leaders came to be known by the CIA and other intelligence agencies that were their principal means of support as the 7 dwarfs. Turkey saw trouble ahead with the greedy and contentious dwarfs, and he repeatedly urged these competing groups to unify under a single command. In 1980, he brought the Mujahideen leaders to Mecca. Ahmed Badib, Turkey's assistant, escorted them. Badib discovered that the most expedient way of silencing the discord among the resistance leaders was to lock them up in a jail in Taif until they agreed to pick Sayyaf, Turkey's man, as their leader. But as soon as they left the kingdom, the jailhouse agreement fell apart. They went back to their old ways, Turkey complained. Fear of bodily participation kept bin Laden well away from the battlefield in the early years of the war, a fact that later caused him great shame. He limited his trips in Pakistan to Lahore and Islamabad, not even venturing as far as Peshawar, then shuttling back home to Jeddah. These frequent excursions eventually cost him his job. By walking away from the Saudi bin Laden group's reconstruction of the Prophet's mosque in Medina, he forfeited his share of the profit, an amount that Abdullah Azzam calculated was 8 million reals, about $2.5 million. In 1984, Azzam persuaded him to cross the frontier into Jaji, where Sayyaf had a camp high in the mountains above a major Soviet outpost. I was surprised by the sad state of the equipment and everything else, weapons, roads, and trenches, bin Laden recalled. I asked forgiveness from God Almighty, feeling that I had sinned because I listened to those who advised me not to go. I felt that this 4-year delay could not be pardoned unless I became a martyr. At 7 in the morning on June 26, 1984, during the month of Ramadan, most of the Mujahideen in the Jaji camp were still sleeping, since they had been praying and eating late into the night after fasting during the day. The sound of a Soviet jet rudely brought them back to consciousness. The men dove for the shallow trenches. The mountains were shaking from the bombardment, bin Laden noted. He was shocked by how low the planes flew as they attacked. The missiles that landed outside the camp were making a huge noise that covered the sound of the Mujahideen cannon as if they did not exist. Bear in mind that if you heard these sounds alone, you might say that there could not be anything louder. As to the missiles that landed inside the camp, thanks to God, they did not explode. They landed as iron lumps on the land. I felt closer to God than ever. Bin Laden recorded that the Mujahideen shot down 4 Soviet aircraft that morning. I saw with my own eyes the remains of one of the pilots, he marveled, 3 fingers, a part of a nerve, the skin of one cheek, an ear, the neck, and the skin of the back. Some Afghan brothers came and took a photo of him as if he were a slaughtered sheep. We cheered. He also noted admiringly that the Afghans had not bothered to jump into the trenches with the frightened Arabs when the attack began. Not one of our brothers had been injured, thank God. This battle gave me, in fact, a big push to continue in this matter. I become more convinced of the fact that no one could be injured except by God's will. Bin Laden immediately returned to Saudi Arabia, and before the end of Ramadan, he raised a fortune for the Mujahideen, between $5 and $10 million, Abdullah Azzam airily recalled. I don't remember for sure. More than $2 million of that came from one of bin Laden's half-sisters. Until now, bin Laden had been seen mainly as a promising acolyte of Sheikh Abdullah's, but suddenly he eclipsed his mentor as the chief private financier of the jihad. Azzam reacted by officially joining forces with his protege. In September 1984, during the Hajj, the two men met in Mecca. Although he was quiet and deferential, bin Laden already had his own plan. Perhaps it had been born in that attack in Jaji, when the Arabs all dove for the trenches. He had observed that the Afghans treated them as glorified guests, not as real Mujahideen. He suggested to Azzam that we should take on the responsibility of the Arabs, because we know them better and can provide more rigorous training for them. The two men agreed to create a more formal role for the Arabs in Afghanistan, although there were few Arabs actually fighting the jihad at that time. Bin Laden undertook to change that by offering a ticket, a residence, and living expenses for every Arab and his family who joined their forces. That amounted to about $300 per month for each household. Azzam added to bin Laden's stunning announcement by issuing a fatwa that electrified Islamists everywhere. In a book eventually published under the title Defense of Muslim Lands, Azzam argued that jihad in Afghanistan was obligatory for every able-bodied Muslim. He had given an advance copy of the text to Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Baz, Saudi Arabia's chief cleric, who wrote a preface to the book, and pronounced his own supporting fatwa in the bin Laden family mosque in Jeddah. Azzam's fatwa draws a distinction between a fard ayn and a fard kifaya. The first is an individual religious obligation that falls upon all Muslims, like praying and fasting. One cannot avoid such duties and be considered a good Muslim. If non-believers invade a Muslim land, it is fard ayn, a compulsory duty for the local Muslims to expel them. If they fail, then the obligation expands to their Muslim neighbors. If they, too, slacken, or there is again a shortage of manpower, then it is upon the people behind them and on the people behind them to march forward. This process continues until it becomes Fard Ein upon the whole world. A child does not need permission from his parents, nor a debtor from his creditor, nor even a woman from her husband to join the jihad against the invader. Fard Kifaya, on the other hand, is a duty of the community. Azam gives the example of a group of people walking along a beach. They see a child about to drown. The child, he suggests, is Afghanistan. Saving the drowning child is an obligation for all the swimmers who witness him. If someone moves to save him, the sin falls from the rest, but if no one moves, all the swimmers are in sin. Thus, Azam argues that the jihad against the Soviets is the duty of each Muslim individually, as well as of the entire Muslim people, and that all are in sin until the invader is repelled. Bolstered by the imprimatur of Bin Baz and other distinguished clerics, news of the fatwa circulated immediately through Islamic communities everywhere. Although it's true that the Arab-Afghan movement began with these two events, Bin Laden's announcement of financial support for Arab Mujahideen and Azam's searing fatwa, one would have to say that their initial efforts were largely a failure. Rather few Arabs actually obeyed the summons, and many who did were drawn as much by Bin Laden's money as by the obligation to defend Islam in the manner that Azam prescribed. As soon as they returned to Pakistan, Bin Laden and Sheikh Abdullah Azam set up what they called the Services Bureau, Maktab al-Khadimat, in a house Bin Laden was renting in the university town section of Peshawar. Bin Laden provided $25,000 a month to keep the office running. The house also served as a hostel for Arab Mujahideen and the headquarters of Azam's magazine and book publishing efforts. The Services Bureau was essentially a repository for the money that the two men were sweeping in through their intensive fundraising efforts. Jamal Khalifa joined Bin Laden and Azam in the Services Bureau, and they struggled to ensure that the donations, which often came in suitcases full of cash, actually got into the hands of the refugees. Azam's long-standing membership in the Muslim Brothers gave him an international circuit to call upon for his ceaseless promotion of the insurgency. Still, his efforts did not compare with those of Bin Laden, whom he called this heaven-sent man, with a direct connection to the Saudi royal family and the petro-billionaires of the Gulf. Bin Laden also drew from his connection to Prince Turki. Twice a month, Turkey's chief of staff and Bin Laden's former science teacher, Ahmed Badib, traveled to Peshawar to deliver cash to the Mujahideen leaders. The Saudi government contributed $350 to $500 million per year for the Afghan jihad. This money was placed in a Swiss bank account controlled by the United States government, which used it to support the Mujahideen. But the Saudis also ran their own programs privately, raising millions of dollars for their favored commanders. More than a tenth of the private money went to supplement Bin Laden's unofficial activities. Turkey says he first met Bin Laden in 1985 or 1986 in Peshawar. They met again, soon afterward, at a Saudi embassy party in Islamabad. Bin Laden would dutifully report his activities to Turkey, such as bringing in heavy equipment and engineers to build fortifications. He struck the prince as shy, soft-spoken, friendly, almost gentle, and highly useful. Through Bin Laden, Turkey could recruit young Arabs to the jihad, as well as provide training and indoctrination outside ISI control. Moreover, Bin Laden was raising large sums of money off the books, a trove that a skillful intelligence operator could put to use. The Services Bureau became a registry for young Arabs who turned up in Peshawar looking for a way to get into the war. It offered these men, or often enough high school students, guest houses to stay in and directed them to the training camps. In a place where magical legends sprouted so easily, bin Laden soon became a part of jihadi lore. Many of the Arab Afghans swore fealty to Azzam, but it was bin Laden who was paying their rent. His wealth and his charity immediately distinguished him. He passed through hospital wards, a lanky, singular figure, handing out cashews and chocolate to the wounded fighters while carefully noting their names and addresses. He built a theological library for the edification of the Mujahideen who were killing time in the city, and he tutored at least one young Afghan warrior in Arabic. He gave money to Sayaf to start the University of Dawa al-Jihad just outside Peshawar in the tribal areas, which would become internationally known as a terrorist training academy. He also pitched in at Jihad, the Arabic language magazine that Azzam published. He was not politically sophisticated like some of the others in the bureau, but he was tireless. An activist with great imagination, Abdullah Anas, an Algerian who worked with him in the services bureau, observed. He ate very little, he slept very little, very generous. He'd give you his clothes, he'd give you his money. Bin Laden did not, however, make much of an impression as a charismatic leader, especially in the shadow of Abdullah Azzam. He had a small smile on his face and soft hands, a hardened Pakistani mujahid recalled. You'd think you were shaking hands with a girl. He was shy and serious, and he struck many as naive. When he laughed, he covered his mouth with his hand. A Syrian who eventually became a confidant of bin Laden remembered their first meeting. It was in November 1985. He had no name at the time. We were in a prayer hall in a guest house. People asked him to talk, so he talked about horses. He said if you love a horse, he will respond to you. That's what was in his mind, horses. Sheikh Abdullah called the small band of Arabs who gathered in Peshawar the Brigade of the Strangers. The Arabs kept to themselves, establishing their own mosques and schools and newspapers. Some had arrived with nothing in their pockets but a telephone number. Thanks to bin Laden's generous subsidy, many of them settled in the suburb of Hyderabad, a neighborhood of two-story tract houses at the edge of the tribal areas, provided with all the modern conveniences, refrigerators, washing machines, dryers, and so on. Indeed, many of them lived more comfortably than bin Laden. Across the Khyber Pass was the war. The young Arabs who came to Peshawar prayed that their crossing would lead them to martyrdom and paradise. As they passed the time, they traded legends about themselves, about the call that had drawn young Muslims to free their brothers in Afghanistan. In fact, the war was being fought almost entirely by the Afghans themselves. Despite Azzam's famous fatwa and bin Laden's subsidies, there were never more than 3,000 of these outsiders, who came to be known as the Arab Afghans, in the war against the Soviets, and most of them never got out of Peshawar. The Arab Afghans were often unwanted renegades in their own countries, and they found that the door closed behind them as soon as they left. Other young Muslims, prompted by their own governments to join the jihad, were stigmatized as fanatics when they did so. It would be difficult for many of them ever to return home. These abandoned idealists were naturally looking for a leader. They had little to cling to except their cause and each other. As stateless persons, they naturally revolted against the very idea of the state. They saw themselves as a borderless posse empowered by God to defend the entire Muslim people. That was exactly bin Laden's dream. In Peshawar, they adopted new identities. Few people in the Arab community used their actual names, and it was rude to ask. In this incognito underground, a child often did not know his father's real identity. The alias usually reflected the name of the Mujahid's firstborn male child or some quality that suited his personality. A common jihadi name, such as Abu Muhammad, would be followed by his nationality, Al-Libi, for instance, the Libyan. It was a simple code, but difficult to decipher, since one had to know a man's reputation or his family in order to catch the reference. It was death, not victory in Afghanistan, that summoned many young Arabs to Peshawar. Martyrdom was the product that Azzam sold in the books, tracks, videos, and cassette tapes that circulated in mosques and Arabic language bookstores. "I traveled to acquaint people with jihad," Azzam said, recalling his lectures in mosques and Islamic centers around the world. "We were trying to satisfy the thirst for martyrdom. We are still in love with this." Azzam visited the United States each year, Kansas City, St. Louis, Dallas, all over the heartland and the major cities as well, looking for money and recruits among the young Muslims who were mesmerized by the myths he spun. He told stories of the Mujahideen, who defeated vast columns of Soviet troops virtually single-handed. He claimed that some of the brave warriors had been run over by tanks but survived. Others were shot, but the bullets failed to penetrate. If death came, it was even more miraculous. When one beloved Mujahid expired, the ambulance filled with the sound of humming bees and chirping birds, even though they were in the Afghan desert in the middle of the night. Bodies of martyrs uncovered after a year in the grave still smelled sweet, and their blood continued to flow. Heaven and nature conspired to repel the godless invader. Angels rode into the battle on horseback, and falling bombs were intercepted by birds, which raced ahead of the jets to form a protective canopy over the warriors. The miracle stories naturally proliferated as word spread that Sheikh Abdullah was paying for Mujahids who brought him wonderful tales. The lure of an illustrious and meaningful death was especially powerful in cases where the pleasures and rewards of life were crushed by government oppression and economic deprivation. From Iraq to Morocco, Arab governments had stifled freedom and signally failed to create wealth at the very time when democracy and personal income were sharply climbing in virtually all other parts of the globe. Saudi Arabia, the richest of the lot, was such a notoriously unproductive country that the extraordinary abundance of petroleum had failed to generate any other significant source of income. Indeed, if one subtracted the oil revenue of the Gulf countries, 260 million Arabs exported less than the 5 million Finns. Radicalism usually prospers in the gap between rising expectations and declining opportunities. This is especially true where the population is young, idle, and bored, where the art is impoverished, where entertainment, movies, theater, music, is policed or absent altogether, and where young men are set apart from the consoling and socializing presence of women. Adult illiteracy remained the norm in many Arab countries. Unemployment was among the highest in the developing world. Anger, resentment, and humiliation spurred young Arabs to search for dramatic remedies. Martyrdom promised such young men an ideal alternative to a life that was so sparing in its rewards. A glorious death beckoned to the sinner, who would be forgiven, it is said, with the first spurt of blood, and he would behold his place in paradise even before his death. 70 members of his household might be spared the fires of hell because of his sacrifice. The martyr who is poor will be crowned in heaven with a jewel more valuable than the earth itself. And for those young men who came from cultures where women are shuttered away and rendered unattainable for someone without prospects, martyrdom offered the conjugal pleasures of 72 virgins, the dark-eyed houris, as the Quran describes them, chaste as hidden pearls. They awaited the martyr with feasts of meat and fruit and cups of the purest wine. The pageant of martyrdom that Azzam limned before his worldwide audience created the death cult that would one day form the core of Al-Qaeda. For the journalists covering the war, the Arab Afghans were a curious sideshow to the real fighting, set apart by their obsession with dying. When a fighter fell, his comrades would congratulate him and weep because they were not also slain in battle. These scenes struck other Muslims as bizarre. The Afghans were fighting for their country, not for paradise or an idealized Islamic community. For them, martyrdom was not such a high priority. Rahimullah Yousafzai, the Peshawar bureau chief for the News, a Pakistani daily, observed a camp of Arab Afghans that was under attack in Jalalabad. The Arabs had pitched white tents on the front lines, where they were easy marks for Soviet bombers. "Why?" the reporter asked incredulously. "We want them to bomb us," the men told him. "We want to die." They believed that they were answering God's call. If they were truly blessed, God would reward them with a martyr's death. "I wish I could raid and be slain, and then raid and be slain, and then raid and be slain," bin Laden later declared, quoting the prophet. The Quran is full of references to jihad. Some of them have to do with the inner striving for perfection, which the prophet had called the greater jihad. But others explicitly command the believers to slay the idolaters wherever you find them, and to fight those who do not believe in God until they pay the tax in acknowledgement of superiority and they are in a state of subjection. Some Islamic scholars explain these injunctions by saying that they apply only when war is initiated by the infidels, or when Muslims are persecuted, or when Islam itself is threatened. The Quran, these thinkers point out, also bids the Muslims to fight in the way of God against those who fight against you, and be not aggressive. Surely God loves not the aggressors. Under the spell of the Afghan struggle, many radical Islamists came to believe that jihad never ends. For them, the war against the Soviet occupation was only a skirmish in an eternal war. They called themselves jihadis, indicating the centrality of war to their religious understanding. They were the natural outgrowth of the Islamist exaltation of death over life. He who dies and has not fought and was not resolved to fight has died a jahiliya death, Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brothers, had declared. He added, with a bit of residual Sufi mysticism, "Death is art." The Quran explicitly states that there is no compulsion in religion. That would seem to forbid waging war against non-Muslims and against Muslims who believe differently. Sayyid Qutb, however, scorned the notion that jihad is just a defensive maneuver to protect the community of faith. "Islam is not merely belief," he wrote. "Islam is a declaration of the freedom of man from servitude to other men. Thus, it strives from the beginning to abolish all those systems and governments which are based on the rule of man over men." Qutb makes the argument that life without Islam is slavery. Therefore, real freedom cannot be achieved until jahiliya is eliminated. It is only when the rule of man has been eradicated and sharia imposed that there will be no compulsion in religion, because there is only one choice, Islam. Yet the declaration of jihad was tearing the Muslim community apart. There was never a consensus that the jihad in Afghanistan was a genuine religious obligation. In Saudi Arabia, for instance, the local chapter of the Muslim Brotherhood refuted the demand to send its members to jihad, although it encouraged relief work in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Those who did go were often unaffiliated with established Muslim organizations and therefore more open to radicalization. Many concerned Saudi fathers went to the training camps to drag their sons home. The fierce idealist who did respond to Azzam's message viewed Afghanistan as the beginning of Islam's return to international dominance, which would see not only the liberation of the Afghans, but also the eventual recapture of all the territory, from Spain to China, that had been under enlightened Muslim domination while Europe was mired in the Middle Ages. The restoration of the former empire was only the first step, however. The next stage was final war against unbelievers, culminating in the Day of Judgment. The Arab Afghans were not all suicidal or apocalyptic thinkers. They included as well the curious, the holiday fighters, the students looking for an exciting way to spend their break. Others were seeking significance that their ordinary lives didn't provide. "I was not a believer," Muhammad Loi Bayazid, a Syrian immigrant to the United States, remembered. 24 years old in 1985, he thought of himself as a typical young middle-class American man, used to shopping malls and fast food, but he had run across a mimeograph tract by Abdullah Azzam and decided that if there were miracles, he would have to see them. He was studying engineering at a community college in Kansas City, Missouri at the time. No one could tell him how to get to the war from Kansas City, so he took a plane to Islamabad and called the number on the tract. If Azzam had not answered, he didn't know what he would have done. Bayazid only planned to stay for 3 months, but he was captivated by the strangeness of the place and the camaraderie of men who courted martyrdom. His expressive black eyebrows and constant stream of wisecracks were strikingly out of place in this sober group of holy warriors. "I went to Afghanistan with a blank mind and a good heart," he said. "Everything was totally strange. It was like I was born just now, like I was an infant. And I have to learn everything new. It was not so easy after that to leave and go back to your regular life." He took the jihadi name Abu Ridha al-Suri. Untrained but eager for action, the brigade of strangers agitated until Azzam agreed to take them into Afghanistan to join forces with the Afghan commander, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who was fighting the Soviets near Jihad Wall. Bin Laden and 60 Arabs rode across the border with a single Afghan guide. Thinking that they were headed directly into battle, they had stuffed their pockets with raisins and chickpeas, most of which they consumed during the long drive. They began referring to themselves as the Brigade of the Chickpeas. Around 10 that night, they finally arrived at the Afghan camp, only to learn that the Soviets had retreated. "Your presence is no longer needed," Hekmatyar impatiently told them the following morning, "so go back." Azzam immediately consented, but bin Laden and some of the other Arabs expressed their dismay. "If they have withdrawn, aren't we supposed to at least chase them?" they asked. Azzam set up some targets on fence posts so the men could have some shooting practice. Afterward, the Arabs surrendered their weapons to an Afghan commander and caught buses back to Peshawar. They began calling themselves the Brigade of the Ridiculous. When they got back to the city, they disbanded. In 1986, bin Laden brought his wives and children to Peshawar, where they joined the small but growing community of Arabs responding to Sheikh Abdullah Azzam's fatwa. It was clear by then that the Afghans were winning the war. Admitting that Afghanistan was a bleeding wound, Mikhail Gorbachev, the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, offered a timetable for the complete withdrawal of Soviet troops. That was also the year that the American-made Stinger, the hand-fired missile that proved so deadly for Russian aircraft, was introduced, decisively tipping the balance in favor of the Mujahideen. Although it would take another 3 bloody years for the Soviets to finally extricate themselves, the presence of several thousand Arabs, and rarely more than a few hundred of them actually on the field of battle, made no real difference in the tide of affairs. Arms shipments poured into the port of Karachi. The ISI, which divvied the weapons among the Afghan commanders, needed a repository, preferably outside of Pakistan but not within the grasp of the Soviets. There is a distinctive portion of the tribal areas that juts into Afghanistan along a range of mountains southwest of the Khyber Pass known as the Parrot's Beak. The northern slope of the Parrot's Beak is called Tora Bora. The name means black dust. Remote and barren, the place is rich in caves made of super-hard quartz and feldspar. Bin Laden expanded the caverns and constructed new ones to serve as armories. It was here, in the warren of ammunition caves that he built for the Mujahideen, that bin Laden would one day make his stand against America. In May 1986, bin Laden led a small group of Arabs to join Afghan forces in Jaji, in Sayaf's territory near the Pakistani border. One night, the Arab tents were pelted with what seemed to be rocks, perhaps debris thrown from the occasional distant bombs. When a Yemeni cook got up to prepare the pre-dawn meal, there was a huge explosion. "God is great! God is great!" the cook cried out. "My leg! My leg!" The Arabs awakened to find mines strewn around their encampment, although they were difficult to see because they were green and disappeared in the grass. As they were evacuating the site, a guided missile struck a few yards from bin Laden. Then a huge explosion on the mountaintop spewed boulders and splintered wood upon the besieged Arabs. Three were wounded, and one, an Egyptian graduate student, was killed.